name's Aaron Ryan. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio.
And my name's Bill Cundiff. Whoa, I'm kind of loud there, Trav. Got a lot of
volume. Take your vitamins this morning?
Yes, I did.
Good job.
Hey, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, and they've got big inventory of tractors, implements, mowers, zero turns. They got it all up there. Go up and see them. Spring's coming. It's right around the corner. Guys, I think it's here today. Got to be 75 out there this morning.
I know. It was balmy.
Yeah, very balmy. And they're also a Honda generator dealer. They're also a steel power products dealer. You can go by and get your new chainsaws, weed whacker, hedge trimmers, anything steel. They probably got it in stock. They got a big inventory of steel right now. So go by and see them or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Not to be confused with the inventory to steal.
No.
Somebody got that confused.
Yeah, somebody was confused.
Somebody was confused by that a couple weeks ago. We hope it didn't come from, you know.
It was an after hours.
Any word fumbling on our part.
Yeah. It was an after hours credit issue.
a 3 a.m. credit issue.
Yeah.
If it's 3 o'clock and you feel like you need to steal products, don't do it. Oh, my goodness. All right. So today is January 17th, 2021, in case we air this again in the future. And not to put too fine a point on it, but there is some amazing stuff on the website today. I put all sorts of stuff that I'm sure we'll talk about and other things that I think you'll find very illuminating. We have two guests with us. Our first guest is Congressman Doug LaMalfa. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us. You can find his bio. He represents the 1st Congressional District, the 11 far northern California counties, except for the coast. And he did a one-minute floor speech. I won't spoiler alert that anyway, but we're going to play it for you. And I have it on good authority that it lit the phones in his offices on fire. So that's always good, you know, when you can incense the entire left side of the country with a 60-second speech, man. That's 60 seconds well spent. Doug, how's it going today?
Pretty good. I get enjoyment out of hearing your analysis of that.
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny because people think, oh, a one-minute speech. I mean, really, what are you going to talk about? And, you can get a lot done in a minute.
Like, if you're concise and know what you're talking about a little bit and have maybe a little bit of a passion behind it, it can go well. So,
yeah, feeling a little annoyed.
Just a little annoyed with what's going on, yes. So, whether it's coming from over the internet or the fish wrap that they call newspapers around here, it does motivate you.
Yeah, who would have thought? I think we all know journalism's mostly, I shouldn't say it's dead, because there are some people who still can write. Our friend Liz Bowen always does a very nice job up there in Siskiyou County, but I'll tell you what, some of our local papers, they feel like they just need to tell people what to think. You know? We're just going to tell you what to think.
You kind of expect that when you're going to get a story or maybe even an editorial that they're going to talk to both sides of the issue, you know, and speak to people on both sides in order to form an informed opinion. Or when it's not the editorial page, which a lot of times is confused with the front page by editors and publishers these days.
Yeah, they tend to overlap. Do you want us to, should we play your 60 seconds and then kind of go from there?
It's up to you.
It's 12:09. Yeah, let's do that. Let's play that fun 60 seconds. We'll take a really swift break right on the backside and come right back with you. Could do that a little early so we don't have to take a bunch of breaks.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second annual Impeachment Show Extravaganza, brought to you by the censors and left-wing media, the fact-checked ministers of shutdown and big tech, and the Democrat Party. Today, the second annual impeachment of President Trump isn't really about actual words spoken out of rally. No. This is all about, Madam Speaker, the unbridled hatred of this president. You use any extreme language and any process to oppose the core of what he has really fought for. You hate him because he is pro-life. strongest ever. You hate him for fighting for the freedom of our religion to not be persecuted by unfair mandates and limitations on speech. You hate him for not subscribing and shackling us with the religion of climate change and one-sided Paris Accords. You hate him for Israel. You hate him for defending our borders. You hate him for letting families and small businesses keep what they earn, for trying to keep the agents of government off their back. You hate him for putting America first, which is what I thought we'd do when we swear the oath. No, this shabby show isn't about a threat to our republic. This is the impeachment and muting of at least half of the American people. This is shameful and abuse of a process.
The gentleman's time has expired. The gentleman from New York.
I yield the gentleman additional 20 seconds.
The gentleman from Ohio yields you another
Madam Speaker,
20 seconds.
I pray people of all stripes wake up to this spectacle and exercise their rights to put a stop to it through free speech and through fair elections.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Make a supersonic man out of you. Don't stop me now.
I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you want to have a good time, just give me a call.
Don't stop me now.
Cause I'm having a good time.
Don't stop me
now. Yes,
I'm
having a good time. I don't want to stop at all.
So since you got reelected, I thought that was probably a good song. So even though they're mad, they can't do anything about it for 2 years. So after the Ring of Fire, what was the, what was the reaction back there? Was it kind of like, hey, nice going?
Oh, on one side of the room was nice going, and there was glares from the other side of the room. I'll let you figure out what the sources of those two.
Well, that's how you always know you're doing a good job.
Well, like they say in NASCAR, you know, if you're not rubbing, you're not racing. Which,
yeah, there you go.
I thought it was, if you're not first, you're last.
That's Ricky Bobby.
Oh, that's Ricky Bobby, okay.
You got that confused with Talladega Nights.
You always want to be first in a listen. Police doesn't typically get you much, except for those tiered elections they have in New Hampshire or something. But anyway.
Well, so, you know, for people, explain. I know that you got, that Jim Jordan gave you a minute of his time. How does the time on something like the impeachment debate, who decides who gets to speak? Because I think sometimes people are mad that they didn't hear from one person or another, but that isn't really always their option, right?
Yeah, that's when a bill or issue resolution is being debated, there's an agreement among the leadership, or maybe some sides, depending on the level of totalitarianism, which it's actually getting worse on House rules for fairness to both sides. They've taken away some tools that we've always had in the past.
Like,
this is one's called the motion to recommit, which is generally the minority party's last shot at trying to add an amendment to a bill before it's voted on. So you'll see us put MTRs up to change the bill in some way. And a lot of times it is used as a tool to put the other side on record as being against some very basic issues. There might be, you know, a bill on crime, and we'll put in there something that says it should remain a felony to attack and harm a police officer. And so, you know, let's watch those other guys vote against that. They will, you know. So, it's, and they've taken away that MTR tool in this new Congress to at least have minority side be heard on a bill before it flies through. So when you're talking about time management on the floor, the on the impeachment vote, as I recall, it was 1 hour assigned to each side, meaning Dems and Reaps are the sides, as you talk about the proverbial aisle that you cross down the center. So Jim Jordan had an hour to manage, and the Dems had an hour to manage on their side. So basically, I've been talking with Jim a little bit lately here, and the day before on the 25th Amendment, he said, hey, Doug, you want to speak on this? I go, nah, not on that. I don't really have anything. on that. But then he asked me the next day, want to speak on this? Like, well, you know what? So I went into the cloakroom and tapped out a speech in about 10 minutes there and came out and said, well, I'd love a little bit of time, Jim. So they worked me in, and that's the result. So.
That was nice, because a lot of the response was, that's exactly what we were thinking. You know, I think you spoke for a lot of people in that instance, and it wasn't
well,
the usual.
I think we're out there listening to folks a lot, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know, and the feedback comes in different ways within an in-person conversation or some of the letters and, well, a lot of communications we get. But I like to think that I got a fairly pulse on what reasonable people are thinking.
Yeah, there you go.
And, the ones that are out there playing by the rules and doing their part and doing all that. There's a lot of other people with opposite opinions, and I'm not very sure that they're as interested in playing by the rules that makes a successful society, but they're allowed their opinion. But I really felt like that was tapping into something that was not being said very much, at least in that venue, about, you know, as the content of the speech said, this isn't so much about someone's perception or twisting of the words said at a rally. This is a deep-seated thing going back four and a half years. You hate this man because he's been older and stronger on the issues listed than anybody has in a long time. Have you seen a more pro-life president ever? No.
No.
Have you seen one fight as hard for religious freedom and that expression ever? No. So,
well, he's the only person to, he's the only president to, I mean, under his, under the budget that was just passed, whether people loved it or hate it, and I did put an analysis that came from the Appropriations Committee on the website for today. So if you still think that the Republicans got rolled on that, I hope you really do go read through it, because that was basically a lie. There is no money in this next year for Planned Parenthood, and that's really a first.
That's a pretty big thing, you know. If and whether it's symbolic or whether it's, I mean, for the unborn lives that can be saved, it's a giant thing.
Yeah. So for all the people who didn't want their taxpayer money to go to Planned Parenthood, you got your wish and probably didn't even hear about it.
Yeah, and that's a difficult thing of when you do a giant omnibus spending bill, which was done the same time and day as a COVID relief bill, and had everybody just, so many people just upset on both sides, but especially, you know, some of our folks we hear from on the right-wing side of things saying that, how could you vote for this? This has got all these bad things. It doesn't have anything for COVID relief. And, you know, I mean, there's just a whole litany of issues that came out because of misunderstanding and the shoddy way the House is being run. I mean, we could have done the COVID relief bill as easily in August or September and had an idea of what to do right and what was needed then. Instead, it came down to December, what, 22? And the omnibus spending package, I hate to call it a spending package, but basically it is the funding of the government for another fiscal year. Well, that's due September 30th, and so we do these temporary measures called continuing resolutions, which kind of is a frozen snapshot of the current spending plan that was in place but expired on September 30th. So you might think, well, that's not so bad, right? It's not some newer, bigger thing. Yeah, maybe, except for you're frozen into a previous spending pattern that says, well, we're going to require this year that the military spend, you know, X amount of money painting the roofs red and all the buildings. Like, well, when you keep extending that spending plan, the company say, well, we've already painted all the roofs red. Okay, now we have to go paint them over again. We have to, you know, give them a different hue. And I'm making a silly analogy here, but it's, you're stuck into the spending pattern of things that are now no longer applicable. And if we went through a better process on that, we would be saying, oh, or listening to them say, well, can we move the funding over here? Or can we stop funding that and we'll come back if we need something new later? You know, but that's what you lose with the CR. So I got a little heat for voting for that package. And but what you have to remember, this is the last Trump package, okay? This is the last Trump spending plan that His guys are right at the table, too. Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin was right there and said, these are the things that we can agree to. It isn't what everybody would want on, you know, maybe the Republican side, but this is what we've hammered out. You know, Pelosi's got her pound of flesh and Schumer and the others, so we can live with this. And that's what we voted for. And so some things happened after the vote that put some of us in a bad appearance, but I didn't agree that we needed to send out $2,000 checks, for example, without it. I mean, at the very least, whatever checks you're sending out have to have a lot stronger criteria as for who's getting them, because you got people that are that were receiving them that are not unemployed or they weren't working to begin with. They weren't in a position where they need the aid as compared to the people that really do, who had their hours cut but are still maybe just outside of being able to be on unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot more complexity to what we're voting on than just, you know, what someone might type out on their social media and attack you with.
Well, people were told, I included, just so you know, I included the letter you put out right around Christmas that went into some detail on this. And, you know, in the political realm, it's a kind of a common, I guess it's kind of like parenting, right, when you're explaining you're losing. So the prevailing sentiment is, oh, just leave it alone. The media will move on to something else and people will forget about it. And
no.
You didn't want to move on and wrote an extensive explanation of what happened with the funding, which I think people would enjoy reading. And in there, just like the explanation of what that package included, 33% was the omnibus budget, 11% was coronavirus aid, and 56% of what you voted on, that just volume of pages, 3,100 pages to be exact, was other legislative bills that had not gone through yet. So maybe tell people why that would all be included in, like, a single vote.
Well, it's the, whether you call it convenience or packaging, or we're running out of time in that Congress. You know, the Congress expired on January 2, and we have to get this work done. You know, we had the continuing resolutions, the temporary spending measures. We were adding, you know, a week at a time or 3 days at a time, even 24 hours at a time of keeping the funding going, all right? And so it gets ridiculous. So the opportunity to get this all done was just winding down to a couple days before Christmas. It all got shoved together, all the leftover legislation that had maybe passed bipartisanly in the House or had come from the Senate that just hadn't gotten around being done yet because, you know, we spent most of the year staying away because of their interpretation of what we need to do with the virus and attendance and all that. I mean, you know, this year, the first time, an unprecedented way of doing business is that we would vote by proxy. The Democrats put that through. We could vote by not being there. So you could designate a colleague who is there and, you know, give them a letter and say, and that's what you see, is that the one present would step to the microphone and there's some legal language said, but on behalf of so-and-so from California, I cast a vote no against this bill. Now, I didn't subscribe to that because I think it's important that we show up. And, you know, I go back to the founders who had to ride, you know, a couple, 3 days on horse and buggy or what have you to get to the Capitol and do their work. And I think that was actually a good firewall of them not doing too much work, you know, spending too much time thinking things up. And, you know,
it's a long horse ride. Do you really want to make it?
Yeah. Do you really want to get there and get rid of the gender terms in the House rules package? Is that what you want to ride 3 days for? You know, so
hard pass.
It was probably a good limitation on having what used to be maybe part-time legislature. So anyway, there's a lot of reasons why things end up the way they do, and the pressure of the government running out of funding and running out of the session for the year. Didn't really want to get that knocked over into a new Congress and have to, you know, take 3 or 4 weeks of revamping all that. So so the package, you know, it did, as you mentioned, did have a lot of catch-all of legislation that had been bipartisan agreement upon. in the House or the Senate. And it's an ugly way of doing business, and that's what happens when you can't get along as well or be productive in conversation. And that's the sad thing, if you want to drill on that proxy voting and Zoom way of doing committees. You know, I mean, we're not even in the same room for committee hearings. And
makes it pretty hard to get on the same page.
It is. You have your witnesses that would come in, and we can ask them and question them in person instead of a, you know, two-inch square on a computer. It's just not the same. You don't get the passion. You don't get the interaction that's necessary to really get a good line of questioning out. And we all know it's easy to get distracted away from a Zoom meeting anyhow. If you're, you know, you're home, you might maybe have your, you know, dress shirt and tie and jacket on. You might be wearing jammies on the bottom, but it's just not a good way of doing business. And this COVID deal has been manipulated to do a lot of things that are stealing our liberties right now. And I don't know where the train ends on this, especially, I know we're deviating here a little bit, but when the vaccine still has all the same restrictions after you take it on how you act and what you go and what you do, I'm just wondering, like, where is the end of this game for these people? So
yeah. Well, and it has a lower efficacy rate than the survival rate of the virus, so that's a little weird, too.
I saw a little math play on that. If you're 99.7% chance of not dying from the virus and the vaccine is 70% effective, that means you have 167% chance, 159% chance of not dying from it, right? Whatever it is.
Yeah. So. I kind of like the picture of the Munsters, for those of us who remember the Munsters, and
What was
her name? Lily? I think her name was Lily, the blonde-haired gal that was the only one who had, like, flesh-toned skin. Everybody else obviously looked like the Munsters. They had white skin and dark, you know, super dark hair. But let's see the caption. When the whole family got the coronavirus vaccine except you.
Yeah.
Of course, we won't know if that's real until later, but it would be kind of scary if the Munsters was also prophecy. It seems like there are a lot of things from our childhood that have turned out to be somewhat prophetic. Yes, but I digress.
I spent a little time having to update the next generation is what the Munsters is. Or
yeah, that's a problem, too.
I had some that hadn't heard of Gilligan's Island, you know.
So. Ooh. How do you get any? You can't get any of the jokes.
No, you got to show them.
Now you got to explain it. So I know that people are one of the main reasons really I wanted you to come on today was, you know, it seems like the prevailing sentiment is always to keep everybody afraid and off balance and demoralized. And so it's pretty easy to do that to, we'll say not Democrats, because they're not all Republicans, but maybe people who are just not Democrats are excited about where we're going with them. What do you see for the House? Like, you know, they're telling folks that, oh, they're going to take away your Second Amendment rights, all your, you know, I mean, they're predicting all these things that are going to happen.
Gun control.
In reality, I mean, obviously, you know, the Munsters was prophecy, we're not. But, you know, what do you see going forward? What's the lay of it to you?
Well, the federal government, you know, our federal system there of the House, the Senate, the White House, and, well, in a way, the Supreme Court. But the legislative activity is going to mirror California a lot more than it has recently, you know, and we know in California there's nothing that they won't propose, that they won't pass, that you can't embarrass them, you can't shame them. And so crazy ideas are going to come from the legislature body in the House, probably most likely in the Senate to an extent too. And, you know, we have to hold on and kind of, the election's every 2 years. I'm elected for 2 years. And so it's a bite-sized situation of survival right now on a two-year cycle. And we also want to be thinking long-term, obviously, about doing great things for infrastructure and putting things in place that would have jobs and manufacturing stay and locate in this country, and they know that they can be here for 30 years or 40 years and operate in a fashion that is predictable and profitable. So I just want to break this down to that for right now, where we are, we're in a, like in a foxhole for 2 years. And the more time they waste when it's the majority that we're going to oppose a lot of their stuff, I guess in a way helps run out the clock like a team with a four-point lead in the last 2 minutes and holding the ball, right? And on a football game. So you just want to get the clock run out until you can get the ball back or get on the field with a stronger team. And so the House is very close to being able to flip to a Republican majority. The Senate, as you see, is 50-50 after that debacle in Georgia here a couple weeks ago where we lost somehow both of those seats. We just picked off one, we'd have 51, and they wouldn't be we wouldn't be looking at a Schumer majority leader and Kamala Harris, Lord help us, as a deciding tiebreaker. So what we're looking at is hunkering down, getting through the 2 years, and flipping very possibly both houses. I think the Dems have a lot more seats to defend in the Senate than the Republicans do. And you know, so you're saying to yourself, well, that means elections. We don't have any faith that elections are going to be fair anymore. There's a lot of that being talked about, too, I'm sure you're hearing, because, you know, the conversation ever since the November 3 election and right up through the 6th when the electoral votes were certified by Congress is that what did go on these elections? How can we have confidence where, you know, did the president overwhip some of the stuff that happened? Yeah, probably. Someone was overhyped. But there are legitimate questions that need to be asked and have been asked to an extent, and I don't think we're adequately answered for us in Congress or in the minds of the general public, you know. So the rally in D.C. kind of played into that. Many Americans are not satisfied that they've gotten the answer that, oh, the elections are perfect, they're fine, there's no high level of fraud. Well, if you want to set that portion aside, we do know from the Texas lawsuit that got, you know, this dismissed because of standing, because of eligibility for those to bring the suit, that there were some issues with the way elections were conducted in Pennsylvania and a couple of the other states where to make a law or change an existing law requires a legislative action. That means you're at the state level is what we're talking about. So your state assembly, your state senate, and a governor's signature to change. Take, for example, in Pennsylvania, something called Act 77. It prescribed that all votes have to be turned in by 8 p.m. to election places, election officials, 8 p.m. on election night. A court just came in and said, we're going to add 3 days. So a court just waved a wand. That's not how you legislate. In other cases, you have secretaries of state, governors, or election commissions just making rules. So that's the crux of what the lawsuit was about, and I think that's legitimate. But if you read the press, you read crappy editorials, you'd see that, this is sedition. This is undermining democracy. This is setting aside the election. Like, well, those are flaws with how they were put together. Does that mean, you know, any of those things? No, I think it's our duty to do that. And that's part of what was going on January 6th when those electors were to be certified.
Well, the other part of that, too, that the media didn't really report is Pennsylvania sent Congress a letter on Monday the 4th and said, hey, don't take in our electors. We've got problems. This is the list of the things we'd like to fix before you guys do that. So for all the people out there who say that...
Yeah, I was just going to touch on that because we got it from their state senate.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have a Republican majority in that senate and their lower house, too. And I think that's part of the reason why their governor and others acted the way they did and said, well, hey, we want to send in mail-in ballots to everybody in Pennsylvania and have no accountability for whether the recipient is dead or alive, whether the address is still valid, whether legal immigrants or what. We just want to send them out. Well, a Republican legislature is not going to just put that out without, you know, some guardrails, if you want to, so to speak, on that. they would have required something a little tighter on that if we're going to have the mail-in ballots because everybody's scared of COVID, right? So that's why they did it by executive action, and that's why we believe that, yes, that is a perfectly good reason. So when we got that letter from the state legislature, which was basically asking for what Ted Cruz had proposed, how about a 10-day timeout? We in Congress will sit down, a bipartisan group, commission, along with five members of the Supreme Court, and weed through this stuff. Because, well, why are you doing it at the last minute? Why didn't you do it before the election, make a change? Or why didn't you do it just right after the election? Because there wasn't time to gather that information. More and more came out. Like in a big trial of the century type deal, you wouldn't have people hustling to get the verdict in. You would allow for discovery and interviewing witnesses and having a long deliberation when you're doing something major like that. So it took time for this to come together, and finally the Pennsylvania State Legislature said, we've got some big problems we really discovered here in the last couple, 3 weeks, and we're asking you and the Congress to hold off that electoral tally for an additional 10 days and take a harder look at this. That's what that all was. But you would think from the nonsense being put out by the editors and in the paper in Reading and in Chico and everybody up and down the media chain here that we were somehow seditionists is one of their favorite words. Like, no, we're asking a legal question, and that's our job to do. And then you want to tack onto that the break into the Capitol on the 6th, where that was underway. You know, we had a two hours to debate on Arizona's electors, then the Pennsylvania one when we came back after work, came back to work after the lockdown. We debated those, and people are screaming, we can't believe after that all the, you know, the violence and stuff that you guys decided to still question the electors for the finish of the Arizona debate and the Pennsylvania one. Like, to me, that's just a mystery how you could think that way. So we're going to let a mob come in, no matter what the makeup of the mob is. Okay, we'll debate that later. The mob came in and tried to stop the people that work in the Capitol from doing their work. And so we're going to stop the work because, oh, the mob spoke. No. You suppress the mob, you get them out of there, and you go back and do the work you're supposed to do to begin with.
Yeah.
And for people to say, well, I'm going to pull off now. We're not going to do this because it caused tension. Well, wait a minute.
Well, you did have some people who did that, which I thought really said a lot about what they consider their job to be. But, you know, the thing that's interesting is two things that were really, I think, just promoted that were absolute lies. They said that you guys were voting to overturn an election, although that was never one of the options. And the other thing was that they tried to take over the government by going into the Capitol.
Called the rioters?
Yeah, they tried to take over the government. It's like, do you think the government lives in there in a box? I mean, what are you talking about? I mean,
don't think by occupying a building.
Yeah, how do you take over the government?
No, albeit a very hallowed building, one that deserves, you know, respect and has a long history that we revere. But by occupying that building does not mean that they have suddenly displaced all the elected members of Congress and are the government, you know?
Yeah, that was not one of the options. I don't think people really thought that through.
Haven't you ever heard of capture the flag?
That's totally what I thought of.
That's what I think it was.
I mean, I asked one lady, I said, so let's just pretend 1,000 armed people, because she's like, well, they were armed. I said, okay, 1,000 armed people go into the Capitol. Now, sketch for me how they take over the government from that position. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess they issued a voting card and they
at the door.
They get a special pin and an outfit and a chair and a desk.
Shucks, you guys have 1,000 here. I guess that's more than 435. So you're in charge now.
You win.
So
I just think it's something
that's why
that's
why there's secret bunkers for the Congress to retreat to if there's a time of a big enough crisis that you have to do that. So you have I'll put in quotes, functioning government.
Sure.
So,
but it's just something for people to consider that when you're told things like that, you really have to look at the source of where you're getting your information because they might actually either be liars or morons. Well, I guess they could be both.
Well, the Democrats have been a four-year against the president. That's what I was touching on in the speech you played at the beginning there.
Yeah.
And they hate him so bad, it doesn't matter. There's no cost that's too high for them. I think the ruined economy from their COVID treatment was a part of that package. And now all of a sudden, shazam, 5 days before the inaugural, you know, Governor Cuomo from New York, and I think the New York mayor, the Chicago mayor, we got to open these things up and save these businesses. do you think we're not paying attention?
Yeah.
And they're banking on that because voters don't seem to pay attention in some cases.
Well, I guess that's why I think it's important for people to understand things like the vote last December. I really hope people go and look at the letter you wrote that kind of unpacks what they were looking at so they can realize how much they were lied to, because it's going to happen again. I mean, I'll say it. You don't have to agree with me, but just my observation. We have Mrs. DeLauro in charge of Rosa DeLauro in charge of appropriations this year. So I'm kind of thinking the crazy lady with the purple hair, who kind of looks like she might be a crazy lady with purple hair, might not be the most studious choice for appropriations. So I look at that and I think, okay, so they're not planning on getting anything done. And if appropriations don't go through, welcome to another omnibus bill, end of the year, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's worth it for voters to get involved.
CRs until you get the omnibus, if you do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the CRs don't have to end on December 22. They can go into the next year. And
right.
You just can't go into a new Congress in a new session, but...
For
your folks that happen to be Democrat that listen here, I don't believe that the ones that get elected or the ones that run things at the high echelon of the party are the same as rank and file regular Democrat people that live in our district across the country. Like, you know, we can disagree at a cafe over a cup of coffee, piece of pie, or whatever. But most of them, I think most people that they choose their party are somewhere not as wound as tightly as the fringes on either side, you know, and the fringes are the ones that broke into the Capitol, whether they were folks that were identifying as Trump supporters but are something much worse, or the ones that were taking advantage of the mayhem that might have been masked over Antifa. You know, this is all still coming out.
If I was an Antifa guy, I'd be wearing a Trump hat and sitting in front waiting for the riot to start. I mean, that would be super smart. We do have to take one more quick break, and then we'll be right back. But I just had to kind of chuckle that you also took some heat this week because you were having a snack, drinking some water, sitting in a corner during the evacuation, and wearing a mask. So we have a good song for that. We're just going to answer it with music, and let that go, because masks are not the law. Newsflash, masks are not the law. So you're listening to We the People. We will be right back with Congressman Doug LaMalfa, and you can find all the information we've been referencing at wethepeopleradio.us.
I don't need you to worry for me, because I'm all right. I don't want you to tell me it's time to come home. This is my life. Go ahead with your own life. Leave me alone. Never said you had to offer me a second chance.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys. You gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
As it should be.
As it should be.
As it should be. we don't have to talk about the mask thing. I just thought it was funny, and it's amazing the things that people get hysterical about, because, again, the media didn't bother to highlight that Nancy Pelosi brought two members of Congress back from her party so that she could win the speaker's chair, and they were in quarantine for COVID, and then some Democrats, I guess, got the virus, which I don't know if you can get it that fast, but whatever. You were eating goldfish in a corner, and somehow you caused an outbreak. It's like,
talk about the timeline here. On January 3, Sunday, we were brought in for, you know, organizing the House. So okay. I'll put that in quotes, too. And, you know, you vote for the speakership, and you put the rules in place. So she was concerned that it was going to be a narrow margin for her getting her speakership. So somehow or another that a couple members that were COVID positive were encouraged to come in and be part of the speaker vote. And so they made a little open top plexiglass booth up in the gallery, the floor above the House floor, you know, where you observe from upstairs, like in a theater, you know, or something. And they made a glass booth that was open over the top. And it's kind of like, you know, a drum set in church, you know, that the drummer, they put him in a plexiglass cage. So it was kind of like that. So they were up there. I wasn't aware of it at the time when we were doing the votes. You find out about this stuff later, you know. So I don't know if I would have wanted to be in the room had I known about that. They didn't disclose that to us members, right? So I wanted to, you know, play.
Well, they never disclosed it at all. I mean, you were Typhoid Mary, but it turns out the two members, just in case somebody thinks I'm making this up, were Frederica Wilson and Tim Ryan. So you can, and I'm sure that they got there in a plastic bubble.
I think one of them was Gwen Moore, I think. But anyway, there's stories about that. So
yeah, they just didn't tell people that. They basically said, oh, somebody wasn't wearing a mask, therefore people got sick. And
the next part, yeah. So that was the third on the swearing in. Two known positive members were up there. I think I saw a photo later of one of them actually not being up there, but was sitting in the front row later on.
Terrific.
So a couple days later, on the 6th, Wednesday, you know, when the Capitol break-in occurred and we were all ushered into a different part of the complex to, you know, wait out what was going on, Democrats and Republicans all got, you know, that were in there all got pushed into this one big room. And so once everybody was settled in and people got into their corners and their little people, groups they were going to hang out and chat with or whatever, that's what was going on. Some of them chose at that point not to wear masks. The Dems that are all paranoid and want to be Karens about it, they could be across the room and choose what they wanted to do. But one of them decided, let's take a video of one of the Dems offering masks to those Republicans in the corner. Well, I was actually a little more by myself sitting at a table, as you alluded to. They had brought us some snacks in, like we had the orange goldfish crackers and a bottle of water. So I was just settled in and munching on a few crackers and drinking a water. It's exactly like flying the airplane. You know, on United, we're to sit in our seats with our mask on until they bring you a snack. You know, about partway into the flight. And so you can take your mask off and munch your crackers and drink your water, and then when you're done, you have to put it back on.
Because you're not contagious. When you're eating and drinking, you're not contagious. We learned that in restaurants.
That's right.
Yeah.
In restaurants, if you're sitting down, you're not contagious either.
You can't sit inside the restaurant, but they can build a tent. They can go rent a tent and put all that stuff up outside. You can sit in that tent outside and eat. And it's the logic has gone out the window a long, long time ago, and you know, Dr. Fauci, the minister of propaganda on that, has changed his mind 6 different times and all that. So, you know, that's you know, when you drill down to the aggravation people are having,
yeah,
people are tired of getting lied to. They're tired of getting manipulated. They're tired of being told something by somebody who isn't logical.
Yeah.
That they can't do it. I know you got a big uprising up there in Shasta County with people with the supervisors and such, and they. You know, they took all the chair seating, you know, the bottom half of the chair out of the room there in the supervisor's chambers. Like, who's paying people to do that? You know, they could,
so no one can sit down.
I'm just running out of words and a way to describe what goes on here. So, yeah, so they made a big spectacle of us sitting in that room under being sequestered away from what's going on. They said, hey, let's have a mask fight over this. And they made a video of it. And so, and they're, at the same time, they're saying, we need to have unity and get along. And they do a gotcha like that, trying to set people up.
Yeah,
of course,
right.
The media runs right with it. They don't They don't mention what you're talking about. They had two known positive members in the room, in the chamber.
Yeah, and Gwen Moore. So. Gwen Moore was one of them. I have the wrong name here. But yeah, she comes from Wisconsin. How did she get there? She had to go there in a. I'm guessing she went there in an airplane.
Oh, I'm sure she went by horseback. So.
The 3-day ride.
You just have all sorts of disingenuous coming out of it. The media reports one side of it. And like, oh, look how irresponsible I have. I was just doing what I was doing, and the other members around me just hanging out. And so, and besides that, none of us actually have the virus, unlike the ones Mrs. P brought in to have to secure her speaker's election. So, you know, you tell me.
Well, I think this year is going to be full of that. And people are going to have to be really discerning, I think, on, because, okay. I know there's an expression, they call them messaging bills, where, you know, they just want to tell it, because a lot of people don't realize it has to, a bill has to pass the House and the Senate both, and then be signed by the President. So if they pass something crazy through the House, it often gets reported, oh, this just passed, and then everybody's hair lights on fire. How much of that do you think we're going to see this year?
Oh, plenty. You know, I get messages all the time about, you know, a gun bill that's been hanging out there for a year or so, and people are still wondering what happened to that bill. Well, that's, you know, bill number 5717. That bill died when the Congress ended, but now you can expect the same or more to come in the new Congress, because they got their president. They're feeling their oats right now, and they have a Senate that's 50-50, that if you can get something through somehow, Kamala will be the tie-breaking vote. So, if we talked a little bit earlier about, is there anything we can look forward to? Is there any hope in all this? And that it's a 2-year cycle, so we hold our breath 2 years, and also that the firewall, there is still firewalls, and Mrs. Pelosi, once they've done, counting the votes in the 22nd district in New York, they're still counting them. Claudia Tenney, a friend of mine, is holding on to about 20 vote lead until they change the rules on how you count them. We're going to be at 222 to 213, I think, is how that's going to settle out. Now, some of the Dems are getting names of administration, so they're going to lose some numbers. So they might be down to maybe 219. That's a 6-vote difference. It only takes 3 to make a tie vote. So the crazier their bills they put out, the more it's going to put their more moderate members on ice to have to vote for really bad, crazy bills in a moderate district. Some of the districts that maybe Trump won in 16, or maybe even currently, and they're going to overreach, because AOC and those folks have major influence on the direction of their party and their policy. So that there's that, and I got to be quick here, but on the Senate side too, Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, who sometimes you can get a little help from.
Yep.
He has promised not to vote with the Dems to get rid of the cloture vote or the filibuster, the ability to take. There's a 60-vote requirement to move legislation to end debate, as they call it. And so that's been a good firewall for the minority party. He's not going to join them to give them a tie-breaking situation to get rid of the filibuster, at least that's what he says. So it's going to take a lot of effort for the Dems to get things through the Senate. On the occasions they do have a 51-vote ability to do so. That's usually just around the budget. So that's a pretty good firewall there, I think. It's a decent one. It ain't going to be great. And you're going to hear, as you said, that so votes are going to pass the House saying, oh, my gosh, we're done for. Like, well, there still is a firewall in the Senate somewhat.
Sure.
And in 2 years. And then they have to be afraid of what they're voting on, too. Because, there's all seats and states that we would hope to hold, and we should hold, probably. And they're going to have a bigger challenge this year, because there's, I think, a lot more Dems and Republicans up at 22 for Senate seats.
Well, that's good.
So they still have to look over their shoulder on this a little bit. So I'm not trying to say, hey, everything's rosy and good.
No, but they have an uphill run. And in the meantime, I would certainly hope that Republicans don't start a circular firing squad, that we focus on actually where, who the problem is.
We've got to watch the Romneys and the other guys that think they're the smartest person in the room and they're going to be above it all. Like, no, we're in the trenches here. So when you talk about the legislative side, the House and the Senate, and how they pass things, that's one thing. The stuff that's going to come down from the administration and their cabinet and the people they appoint and the ones that get confirmed.
Yeah, that's going to be
where we got to. That's where I'm.
The good part is they're the same bureaucrats from Obama. Congressman Doug LaMalfa, thank you for being with us this morning. We think you're an all-star, and we thought we'd play a song about that. We'll be right back with our next guest. We're here on for another hour.
Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
Good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery will get you pretty much anything you want. If it's a John Deere product, they can get it. Also, they have Honda.
Ta-da!
Generators.
Oh.
Yeah. Go by and see them. Summer's just around the corner. We'll have
they're
fire
quiet.
Season.
Honda generators, they're quiet.
Oh, they're very quiet. Very dependable. And, well, they're so good, people will steal them, so.
They're so great, they'll break in at 3 o'clock in the morning to get one.
Just
for,
to get one,
on
yeah.
the five-finger discount.
That's right. Yeah, so go by and see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
That's probably a 10-finger discount, though. They're kind of heavy.
Yeah, they are. In fact,
for those of you that aren't old and don't know what that means, you'll have to look that up.
We did get a little chortle. We had them all on camera, and they couldn't get the last one in the van because it was too heavy, so they just left it in the parking lot.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a thieves that don't plan very well.
No.
Okay. So you can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. There's a lot of information from today's show. Today is January 17th, 2021, in case we replay this at a later date. But wanted you to know that the interview with the congressman in the first hour has a lot of backup information online, and I really do hope that you go look at it because it's pretty informative. And we will also have commercial-free archives of both shows up later on today. So if you're out doing something because it's a kind of a nice day, I mean, you might be snowed in. Depends on where you live. But if you missed part of this or all of it, wait till the commercial-free thing comes out, and you can listen for free. So our guest this hour, I'm kind of excited. We've waited a few weeks to get this put together. His name is Peter Wood. He's the president of the National Association of Scholars. No pressure, Bill. Get on your thinking cap. He's the author of a new book called 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. He's the former professor of anthropology and a college provost. He's the author of several books about American culture, including Diversity, the Invention of a Concept. Wasn't that some invention, too, in 2003. And A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now, 2007. And I think that was way ahead of its time. Probably going to have to do a sequel. A frequent media guest. He does all sorts of television and radio. And I'm just excited to have him on because I think that this 1619 project is something that has been thrown around in passing, but I'm not sure people really realize what that is and what the significance is. So I'm really happy to have you with us, Mr. Wood.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you just fire away and let us know what I mean. Let's just figure most of us out here in the rest of the world. Well, we'll just start with the fact that we're not part of the National Association of Scholars, which is why we've never met. but we have stayed at the Holiday Inn Express, so there's hope for us.
They're still looking over my application.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Bill's caught in processing. But I don't think people really realize how dangerous this is. I mean, in all seriousness, this is a rewrite of history.
That's exactly what it is. In August of 2019, the New York Times published a special issue of its Sunday magazine titled The 1619 Project, so that's where it begins. And it is set up as a complete redo of American history. It ends on its last page with the announcement by the Pulitzer Center that they will be rolling it out as a curriculum in the nation's schools, and they've lived up to that. So
they're teaching this.
Oh, yeah. It's being taught in the schools right now, or at least some schools. It's a kind of hard question of which schools. We know Chicago and Buffalo have both formally adopted it among some districts, but in many cases they've gone directly to teachers, so the district may not even know that it's being taught in some of their classrooms.
Oh,
so
lovely.
It's a, yeah.
Give us a kind of a thumbnail of what it is that they're teaching, because I think that'll be illuminating for people.
Well, the 1619 Project is so named because it starts with the claim that in August of 1619, 400 years earlier, slaves had been brought to Jamestown, Virginia. That was the beginning of slavery in America, they say, and that becomes also the beginning of what the Times called slaveocracy, or white supremacy, and that since then, every significant detail in American history it has depended on the perpetuation of slavery or its descendant institutions like Jim Crow laws, and that this is a story of America that, rightly understood, is about white supremacy beginning to end. Oppression Studies 101. There are a lot of problems with this, which were apparent the moment I picked it up and started reading it. One is the notion that the America's ideals were false when they were written. That's a direct quote. The ideals in question are liberty and equality, that those were simply disguises that were put up to prevent people from challenging the new forms of racial oppression. The claim that slavery began in Virginia in August of 1619 is false in a whole bunch of ways. The claim that the American Revolution was fought in order to perpetuate slavery is false. The idea that Abraham Lincoln brought about the Civil War in order to exile black Americans to another continent is false. The idea that the American economy is based on plantation slavery and that the prosperity of the capitalist system derives directly from how plantations were run is false. The idea that black advances in civil rights have always and only been due to the self-help of blacks with no help from whites is false. And you can go on like that. This document is made up of a long, long string of claims that don't stand the inspection of anybody who knows the actual history.
And I'm sorry, who was the author, the original author of this?
Well, the original author and editor is a woman named Nicole Hannah Jones. The 1619 Project consisted of 10 essays, so she has 9 co-authors, as well as the senior editor from the Times named Jake Silverstein. And then there were a couple dozen smaller contributions to this, ranging from photographs to drawings to poems. So it's a collaborative effort. It's presented with no historical sources at all. It's just straight-out narrative without any reference to people or documents or sources of information that would have made it checkable in an easy way. So we have this mythology basically presented as though it was history, and it's accompanied by quotations that say basically we're telling the true history for the very first time. Well, they may be doing something for the very first time, but true history is not.
No.
And just not citing any sources. That's pretty. Right. That's not exactly how scholarly works are done.
No, it's not. But of course, this is a newspaper, and newspapers generally don't write history. They report news, and I think the Times deliberately decided that this was going to be a new venture for them. They've treated it that way. Unlike other stories they've printed, this one got its own advertising budget. They ran 60-second television advertisements, one of them during the Super Bowl. So they were willing to spend quite large amounts of money to get this into the public ear and eye. And I think they've succeeded.
Wow.
That's just stunning. It's just stunning. And so, it's stunning too that the
school systems just pick it up and run with it without any background or you know, investigating of their own.
Well, I think it tells you something about the nature of the education that many teachers now receive, that they are not really skeptical about this kind of claim. For a good many years now, one of the most popular textbooks in the country has been Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., and it, too, is a fabric of distortions and claims that don't stand the light of day. The people who promote the Howard Zinn approach to history have taken up the 1619 Project with enthusiasm. So there are segments of the world of teachers and education that kind of endorse the idea that America is a rotten place, has been from the very start. It's founded on genocide, oppression, the demeaning of people in order to control them or extract their labor from them. It is a picture of our country that is just not recognizable if you have spent any time at all reading actual history.
But if you're a kid in school, and this is where you're learning history, you're not going to hear the other side unless your parents are really paying attention.
This will be your first exposure to history, and it'll be just amazing.
And so we can have a whole new crop of people who are wholly misinformed. What a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
God, you know, it's funny, if you were evil and bad, this is a great time to be alive. I guess it's always been a great time to be alive, but what the heck? All right, we have to take a really quick break so we can be incensed in our cone of silence here. And we're going to come back with our guest, Peter Wood. He has written a book called 1620, and I really do think you're going to learn a lot this hour if, in fact, you can keep your hair from catching on fire. So switch to decaf and join us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You've taken my life, so take my soul. Good.
Oh, isn't that the truth of it? Wow, this is, I read through all the material that your fabulous publicist, Stephen Manfredi, sent to us. God bless him. He really does a great job of sending us folks like you that might not be heard. And if somebody wasn't interested in the topic, they might not know of the book, which would just be a crime. Absolutely a crime that this stuff is going on right under everyone's nose. And it would be allowed. I mean, everyone knows the New York Times, you know, publishes crap, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I don't think, it's not like that's, you know, an authoritative publication anymore. But he had sent us a list of questions, and okay, it's just a personality problem, but, you know, you send me a list of questions. Those are not the ones I'm using. But he actually has some really good points in here. You probably helped him with it. That it says here that it's part of a larger effort to destroy America. Expand on that, because I really think that that's true.
Well, it's a big claim on my part, but I think that it is true. America really depends on people having some confidence that our liberties, our freedoms, our sense of equality are justified and real, and that our nation is not simply a place of run by bandits for their own good. If you teach people that their right response to America is to hate the place, there really is no fabric of a civil society. There's no possibility of sustaining a country based on self-hatred. So when I say destroy America, I mean destroying the value base that enables us to live with one another even when we disagree.
Well, and I think we all see that now. The people who, you know, are looting and burning, you know, our major cities and all those kinds of things. It's pretty clear just in that behavior and then what comes out of that, that they do hate the country. And these people haven't even been indoctrinated with stuff like the 1619 Project. They're not even in school anymore for the most part.
No, they're not. But the 1619 Project leaped beyond the control of the Times pretty quickly. July, I think it was, Charles Kessler, the head of the Claremont Institute, made a comment that the riots that had broken out post George Floyd's death could be called the 1619 riots.
Hmm.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is the principal author of this thing and a ferocious Twitterer, responded almost immediately saying, yes, bring it. I accept that they are the 1619 riots. That's a slight paraphrase, but she owned that comment. Why? What did the riots have to do with 1619? Well, 1619 is saying America was racially unjust from the beginning, and every aspect of its continuing life, its prosperity, those businesses that got burned down, the law enforcement authorities are all people who are part of the great racist conspiracy. So going out and having yourself a little riot was no big deal. Once the property destruction started to mount up to many, many millions of dollars, Nicole Hannah-Jones thoughtfully explained to the world that that wasn't violence. Violence is when you attack a person, but burning down a building or a courthouse or some small business, that's not violence, that's just protest. So we have the 1619 Project on record by its primary author as something that says the hatred of America can legitimately be expressed by trying to destroy the place. She's not alone in that. I think what we have in 1619 becomes apparent when you look at the pictures of statues that have been toppled, like George Washington, spray-painted once he's down on the ground, 1619. It's now a signature by the looters and rioters to call what they're doing 1619.
Oh.
So we're in a world that the Times helped to create. Now the Times, of course, has the vapors when it sees a couple hundred people roaming through the hallways of Congress. But
they're
pretty much okay with the idea that black neighborhoods can be burned down and small business owners who are themselves black can have their livelihoods destroyed and their property vanished.
And police. Don't forget the police. We only care about them if they work at the Capitol.
Exactly.
It's just, okay, so they've taken our whole history, made it upside down. Is this something you can only really find online? It's not, 1619 Project is not really like a book or anything like that?
Well, that's a really good question. They did not bring it out as a book. They published it in that original magazine form, and I'm grateful that I had the foresight to save it. They went through a period of about 7 or 8 months in which, despite being told by many prominent historians, mostly people on the left themselves, that it was full of inaccuracies, they stubbornly refused to make any corrections or changes. It just stood available online in the form it was originally published. Then a historian named Harris, a woman who teaches American history, who had been called on to fact-check the original document before it was published, came forward on Politico to say she had warned them that they were committing major errors, and they refused to fix them. After she criticized them, they went back and made one tiny correction in the whole document. It was two words, and the words were "some of," and they got inserted at a place where instead of the American Revolution being fought by the colonists to preserve slavery, only some of the colonists were fighting for that reason. Well, the historical fact is none of them were, because it just wasn't an issue at the time. But that was the only change they made, and after that, the original record vanished. Only the revised record was available. Then something more happened. In September, President Trump gave a talk at the National Archives in which he called out the 1619 Project for its falsehoods. And instead of the project becoming an instrument to bludgeon him with, it looked like it was going to become something that the New York Times would get bludgeoned with. At that point, the Times did something really sneaky. They went back into the document and changed a lot of things. They paraphrased them. They reduced the more absurd claims to something that were slightly more defensible. And they did this without any public acknowledgement that they were making corrections. It's called stealth editing, and it's one of the worst things you can do as a journalist, which is to change your published words without acknowledging that that's what you're doing. Well, we called them on that. I got together a group of about 20 historians. We sent a public letter to the Pulitzer Foundation saying, given that they just provided Nicole Hannah-Jones a Pulitzer Prize for her journalism, here she is showing how undeserving she is of that prize, and they should revoke it. Of course they didn't, but the mere asking for it, I think, helped draw some public attention to how sleazy this enterprise really is.
Wow. Can't hurt. Okay, it goes through all this fake history, but I think your point is well taken, that fake history is more dangerous even than fake news, because we spend a lot of time looking at the fake news. We have like a minute till our break, but from your vantage point, why do you say that?
Fake history pollutes our minds for generations at a time.
Yeah.
And there is no easy way to correct it once it gets the authority of schools and colleges behind it. Most of us don't go back and read original historical sources searching for the truth of matters. We take what is presented publicly as pretty much face value. As you say, fake news gets corrected pretty quickly. At least 75 million of us know certain things happened that others are saying didn't happen. And no matter how much that gets shut down, we know the truth. I think it's going to be harder when it comes to something like the 1619 Project, something like the idea that slavery began in America in 1619 sounds somewhat plausible. Who knows what happened back in Jamestown then? Well, I won't try to give you all the details right now, but what the Times said happened just didn't happen. So,
when we come back, I want you to tell people why you called it your book 1620, because I kind of skipped over that at the beginning, but I think that's a good point, and I think it's important really for people to know that this is out there, and especially people with kids in school, even college age kids, they should be asking, are you hearing this at school?
Yeah. And also 1620 is a book.
Yeah, it's written by a scholar.
That's
oh my
right.
gosh, what
That's
a great
right.
idea. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Wood. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
In your ears, you turn around, come around back on you. Well, that little white lie's catching up to you.
Little white lie.
far from Little White Lies, but they didn't have any songs about big lies that I had available anyway. I had to go with the Little Lies. So you called your book 1620, and that wasn't just because it was a year after 1619, right?
No, it was not. It was because something important happened in 1620 that I think is of great importance more than anything that happened the year before. That was in November of 1620, a ship arrived off the coast of Massachusetts, bringing with it a bunch of religious dissenters from Holland, along with some would-be farmers who were headed to Virginia. The ship had been blown off course and had arrived much later in the season than anyone expected, and dissension had broken out on board. The religious group, the people we call pilgrims, and the would-be settlers, whom the pilgrims called the strangers, became angry with each other. The strangers said they had sailed across the Atlantic on a contract with a British land company, and now that they weren't in Virginia, they were free to go where they would want to go and do whatever they wanted. The pilgrims were saying that's probably not a very good plan, given that we don't have any food. It's too late to plant any crops, and we don't know what kind of reception we're going to get from the natives. So they sat down, and they worked out an agreement, which we call the Mayflower Compact. That was signed on November 11th, 1620. And why that short document, it's fewer than 200 words, matters is that it laid out for the very first time a vision of self-government in the New World. They decided that they were now outside English law, so they were going to elect their own leaders. They were going to decide on their own laws in a democratic way. They were going to abolish hierarchy. So this document was signed by the servants as well as the masters, by the young under age 21 as well as the elders. It became a charter for a new way of thinking of a self-governing community. It wasn't just a piece of paper. Once they got on shore, they put it into practice, and it remained in force for 25 years, during which time the later groups of religious dissenters we call the Puritans arrived and sort of took over. But the Mayflower Compact gave rise to a community that was able to reach and sustain a treaty with the local Wampanoag Indians. It provided a form of the rule of law based on equality. It was a genuine breakthrough in world history at that point. The whole idea of self-government by a bunch of people who disagreed with each other but saw the need to hang together. The model of what happened at Plymouth became a basic template for the settlement first of New England and then of much of the rest of America. Our ideals of small-town government derive from the Mayflower Compact. Therefore, if you're going to go back to the very early days of English settlement of the New World, you can find something that really does sustain itself in a positive way over the next 400 years. And it's not slavery. There were no slaves in Plymouth. Never were. And then we are in a path here, I think, to a better understanding of who we are and where our values come from. Some call the Mayflower Compact an early draft of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration is, of course, a much more eloquent, serious document that lays out our vision of our really core values. But everything that's there has got a predecessor in the Mayflower Compact. It's a short document worth knowing.
Yeah, they had it on display, actually, at the Library of Congress a few years back. I happened to be in there at the time, and I was surprised at the size. I mean, it's such a...
Tiny.
It's such a... kind of like Plymouth Rock. I mean, two men and a boy could pick that up. But the Mayflower Compact was not very big, and yet it did set the stage for so much more.
So when did the slave trade hit our shores?
Well, there's several layers to the answer. First, it was here already by the time European settlers arrived. Slavery had been practiced in both North and South America for at least over 1,000 years that we can tell, Native American tribes practiced slavery. They enslaved each other, and when Europeans came along and could be captured, they were enslaved as well. So slavery is an indigenous institution in that sense. But then when the Spanish found that enslaving the Indians wasn't working out very well for them, they started importing slaves from West Africa, and the Portuguese and the Spanish both were bringing over slaves in very large numbers starting in the 1500s. And so more than 100 years before Jamestown, there were millions of slaves already in North America brought over by Spanish and Portuguese, Portuguese to Brazil, Spanish to everywhere else. The English did not take up an interest in slavery until later. So here we have the claim about Jamestown goes wrong in another way. I mean, those people who were brought to Jamestown by an English pirate ship in August of 1619 were not recognized as slaves by the Virginians. They didn't have a legal status of slavery, so they turned these 20-some captives into indentured servants, and a short time later let them go free. Some of them intermarried with the white population. Some of them became prosperous landowners. We know that they had full legal rights because of their entry into the court system, where they sued and won against white neighbors. So what we had in 1619, contrary to the New York Times, is an early and kind of odd experiment in racial integration. Slavery lay in the future.
Well, that certainly would be nice to know if you were in grade school or
yeah,
high school.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and this doesn't... I think that things like this sometimes aren't opposed because people are chicken. But on a broader level, they think, well, you know, it was bad and this will help. I guess this will help racial issues now.
I think you put your finger right on it. I think a lot of people who could know better or should know better are thinking, well, it may not be exactly true that this is a good way to recognize how bad the country has been to people of African origin. And maybe if we just squint at this, it'll do some good. It'll make people feel better. But I don't think you make people feel better by teaching them lies. Or maybe you do make them feel better, but the consequences for that are going to be pretty dire later on.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what you get when you start tearing down statues and all that. They believe that, you know, that's bad history. So
yeah, we'll get rid of those people, and if we don't talk about them, they weren't there.
Yeah.
Which obviously isn't how that works. But, you know, the other part of it is I think that all of this has just stoked racial tension. It hasn't actually helped.
I think it was intended to stoke racial tension, and it's a sort of accomplishment by the authors of it that they succeeded in doing that. We're living in an era right now in which animosity based on identity is taken as a matter of pride. In your intro to me, you mentioned a book that I had written some time back titled A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now, which is really about our turning anger into a virtue when it used to be seen as kind of dangerous and maybe something that you wanted to get under control. Well, my book is now about 15 years old, and the publisher wants to bring out a new edition, and so I'm working on that as my next project. But it connects to this. This is an era in which stoking anger, even if you have to engage in deception to do it, is seen as such a good thing. Anger is empowering. People won't really stand up and fight for what you want them to fight for unless you can rouse them to some degree of fury. I don't think that's something that happens entirely on the left, but it is the left's specialty. You know,
it is their specialty, and I think that in a lot of cases the right has adopted that as well, and you can see it, you know, people see that in their emails. You see it in your emails. You get these emails that they don't tell you what the legislation is, but they are passing a bill about blah, blah, blah. Don't tell you what it is, so you can go look it up. they just give you some incendiary clip of it, and we're going to fight it, send us money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's become a tool. And besides that, people aren't very smart when they're angry. And that's not usually where you do your best thinking when you're mad. So if we keep everybody mad, nobody will see through any of this, and they'll just race from fight to fight. I don't know.
Anger brings a kind of clumsiness that's intellectual mostly, but it's physical too.
Mm-hmm.
And in the martial arts, you're taught to fight with a cool head, not to get mad. So here we are teaching people to be mad first and then think later, if at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't stop and don't do any research, for heaven's sakes. We just need to believe.
Well, that's already been done for you.
Yeah, we just need to believe what people tell us. And you know, it almost is always true when it sounds so far out there and so like this. Those of us who are over 10 years old know that the country wasn't founded on slavery, I think. And so when you hear something like that, I mean, your internal buzzer ought to go off. You know, hey, wait a minute, there might be something funky going on with this. We're going to be right back with the author of 1620. His name is Peter Wood. You can find that at encounterbooks.com. And I think this is actually, I guess Christmas is over, but what is it? Valentine's Day is coming up. This would be a terrific Valentine's present. I think you ought to consider investing. When we come back, we'll find out how big the book is. Not to spoiler alert it for people, but we'll find out how scholarly it is and how long it will take you to read it. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You see, it's all clear. You are meant to be here. From the beginning,
truth. Everybody does want to rule the world. So give us a spoiler alert. Is this a hardback book, a softback book? Is it big? Is it little?
it's a hardback book.
Nice.
With a delightfully pretty cover that has gotten some nice comments on Amazon. So it's a book that you can put out and not be ashamed to have on your table. It's about 250 pages long.
Oh, and there you go.
It's very readable. One of the things I can boast about, because it's not my doing, is that the publisher just made a nice book out of it. I think that at its current length and style, most people could probably read it within a few days. I did not intend it to be a heavyweight scholarly book that was going to put people off. My whole idea here was to present this to the public in a manner that made it as accessible as possible.
That's awesome, because I think sometimes when you it's written by the president of the National Association of Scholars, people are like, yawning. you know, it might be boring.
Does it have pictures? Aaron likes pictures.
Aaron was an English major. It's Bill who goes for the pictures. Let's just be clear there.
I tried to put pictures in it, but the pictures I wanted were images from the New York Times. And for some reason, they decided that the prices that they were going to charge me for those were through the roof. So
that's one way of keeping them from being called on the carpet. Well, that's an important point, though, because I think sometimes when we're talking about a response to a rewrite of history, it might seem like, well, I don't really need to know this. But, you know, the things that you're going to talk about in this book will be things that we learned in school, I'm sure.
they should be the things that everybody learned in school. I'm not quite as confident about people who graduated from high school in the last 10 years or so. They may well have already been consuming versions of our history that I wouldn't recognize, but there we go.
That is just so creepy. I mean, we're old, so, you know, and I grew up on the East Coast, so I learned all the Revolutionary War and all of that history. It's all right around you.
You didn't know squat about Sutter's Fort, though.
No, I didn't. And I was pretty dopey about the missions, too. We were busy visiting actual historical sites. But I think that things like this, do you see this, I'm just guessing, but I'm probably, it's probably unfortunately correct, this is probably picking up steam?
I think it is. I say that, however, without real hard evidence. The Pulitzer Center, which was responsible for rolling it out to the schools, decided after a while they weren't going to tell you anymore how many teachers had adopted it or which school districts were using it. I think they caught on that information could be of value to the opposition. So right now it's kind of tough to figure out how far it's penetrated in the schools. As you know, we already mentioned that the rioters like to spray paint 1619 on their handiwork, so I think it's pretty broadly disseminated amongst the radicals, the Black Lives Matter, the Antifa folks. They know it chapter and verse. What's less clear to me is what ordinary Americans of all races actually know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Back before the Great Shutdown, when I would ask live audiences who had heard of the 1619 Project, so this was 6-7 months after it had been published, virtually nobody had. It had at that point gained a lot of ground in the schools without penetrating the public awareness of it. I think that changed dramatically when President Trump at that speech at the National Archives brought it up. I spoke that day as well, and it was clear that the White House staff were now on top of this. Now, what happens next, I think, is really worth paying attention to. I would not be surprised if President Biden thinks that the 1619 Project is exactly what the country needs, but I don't want to prejudge it. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, they'll have a lot of other bad ideas that might, you know, happen first, but I'm sure it's on the list. Tell me this. What is, besides learning about it, I mean, if you don't know about it, you can't fight it, but what would be your advice? One of the last things that Stephen included for us is, what can the average citizen do?
Well, I think there are several things the average citizen can do. First, find out whether it's being taught in your schools, and don't assume that when the school board says it's not, that answer is definitive, because the Times has marketed it over the heads of the school boards. It's bad enough if the school board is in favor of it, and if it is, then you may want to consider running for the school board or promoting a candidate who is determined to stop this particular disgrace. A second thing that you can do is reacquaint yourself with some basic American history. The stories of what happened, what really happened, are dramatic, and they fully hold interest. You can't really bore people to death by getting the narrative of what happened at Concord and Lexington restated, or Bunker Hill, for that matter. Or the Pilgrims, I think that's a story that can hold its own. It doesn't have to be treated with a candy coating. It was a story of immense suffering and overcoming. Worth knowing, you cannot teach your children those stories unless you have a feel for them yourself, and that takes a little bit of effort, not a great deal, but acquaint yourself or reacquaint yourself with some American history and bring it up at the dinner table or whenever. People are home a lot these days, and it's a good opportunity to open up a conversation in which you can give your children a sense of the American past that they probably are not going to get in their schools. Or if they are going to get it in their schools, it's going to be all the better that they've already heard some version of it from their parents. Remember, school teachers are treated by children, at least before high school, as pretty much authorities. What they say, kids accept because they don't ever hear anything different. Well, maybe this is a case where they should hear something different so that they have some immunity when their teachers start telling them things that are false. So those are the two simple things that every American can do, and I strongly recommend doing them. There are other more complicated things you can do, like, you know, buy 100 copies of my book and send it to your friends.
Yeah.
But there are other organizations like the 1776 Unites, which is a black group that is promoting alternatives to the 1619 Project, that are well worth knowing about. So if you begin to dig into this stuff, you'll find that there are other avenues to try to influence public opinion. And, you know, while you're at it, maybe you should cancel your subscription to the New York Times if you have one. I feel obliged to read it, but I'm reading it for you.
Yeah, and, that makes one of us. Tell me this. I realize ideas like this can be marketed to any age group, but what do you feel the target age is, or what are you hearing, or what's your research shown? What's the target age where they want to roll this out?
Well, the curriculum that they put forth is broken into pieces to make it right for every grade level, starting first grade. So some version of this is reaching children at a very young age. I think the main thrust of it, though, is probably for junior high and high school, where kids begin to get naturally a little bit cynical or skeptical, and here's a version of history that says everything that's been taught up till this very moment has been a lie, and now we're telling you the truth. I think people fall for that gimmick quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The Times magazine itself was, I think, intended for a mostly adult audience, at least, you know, those folks who generally see themselves as righteous liberals who want to show that they're on the right side of history, and that means getting rid of white supremacy and anything that can be shoved into that category. So there is an appeal to the elite as well as to the students.
Sure. Well, I mean, how many times did you hear that the events at the Capitol on the 6th was obviously about racism because the people were white? And it's like, well, I guess I'm not connecting those dots. I'm almost 60. I was taught that if your premise is about the color of someone's skin, that is racism. And I wasn't taught that it was because people were black. That was just, if it's about your skin color, something you can't fix, it's just
I think that's a
straight up racism.
Perfectly accurate definition of what racism is. But, of course, racism is being redefined by these folks. That they now say it's about, it's asymmetrical. It's only whites who hate blacks and don't even know it because now it's implicit racism.
Yeah, because they're white, and how would they know? Oh,
yeah.
Gosh, we have entered the ring of insanity. Peter Wood, thank you for spending the hour with us. I cannot believe we're out of time. I hope everybody runs out and gets 1620, a critical response to the 1619 Project. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, you've been listening to We the People. You can find the archives on these shows for today at wethepeopleradio.us.